more weeping than wailing. I'm going home to live with God.
This is the second in our three-part Chautauqua series, in which we're bringing to you the voices of some of the leading figures in America. This week we welcome Booker T. Washington, educator, reformer, and the most influential spokesman for Black America. The year is 1901. Welcome, Mr. Washington.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about your childhood. You were born in 1856 in Virginia. What was it, to a slave family?
Indeed, I was thereabout. I was born on the Burroughs Plantation. That's near Hales Ford in Virginia. I lived there with my mother, my sister Amanda, my brother John, my half-brother James, until the coming of Emancipation in 1865. Then we followed my stepfather, my mother's husband, to Malden, West Virginia, and I spent most of my childhood there in Malden.
What do you remember about your early life? Do you remember anything about slave conditions or the immediate years after emancipation?
Oh, indeed I do. I guess the thing that I remember with the greatest amount of nostalgia, being an educator now, is the great desire that I had for an education. I would sometime follow my mistress to the schoolhouse door, and I could oftentimes look in through a window, and the sight of those little white children there getting the mystery of learning, I thought that that would be second only to heaven if I could ever get inside a schoolhouse door.
But even though you were denied an education at that age, you still managed to enter Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute, where you took your degree and even returned later to teach. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, after going to Malden, I was employed in the salt mines. I was helping Mr. Wash Ferguson, as I believe, pack salt. And each of the salt packers were assigned a number. And Mr. Ferguson's number, as I remember, was 18. And that was the first figure I ever learned to figure. And I began to realize that every packer had a number, and so I gradually learned my figures from that. And, it wasn't too much long after we moved there, and there was a young black man from Ohio who came to town. And we would often see him outside reading newspapers, and the Negroes would gather around, and he would give them the topics of the day, and I was quite impressed by that. And then finally another Ohioan came to town, and he started a school, Mr. William Davis, as I remember. So this was around September of 65, and he became my first teacher. This was a part of the Freedmen's School movement. I guess my second most important teacher, although it wasn't in the schoolhouse, was the woman that I was worked as a houseboy. That was Mrs. Viola Ruffner. Mrs. Ruffner was the wife of General Lewis Ruffner, who was one of the most prominent men in the community. But it was during the time that I spent with Mrs. Ruffner that I learned the value of cleanliness, and I learned the value of loving work for work itself. And I often said that I learned about as much from Mrs. Ruffner as I did any schoolhouse I ever attended. I was down in the mines one day, and I heard about that there was a school that was set up in Virginia for freed slaves called the Hampton Institute. And I eventually convinced my mother to allow me to go to Hampton, and indeed I did. I was at Hampton from 1872 to 1875. There I was under the influence of a number of important teachers. Most importantly was Mrs. Mary Kay Maggie, who was the woman principal of the school, and certainly my greatest man in my life was General Samuel Chapman Armstrong. And I left Hampton after I graduated in 75 and did some teaching in Malden, and went and spent a year at Wayland Seminary in Washington, D.C. And in the spring of 79, General Armstrong invited me to come back to Hampton to take over the night school there. And I was there from 79 to 81, teaching in the night school, and eventually in 80 to 81, I was head of the Indian school there. And it was in the following year, the summer of 81, where General Armstrong received a request from two gentlemen in Tuskegee, Alabama, to recommend a white man to come down there to set up a school. And the general said he didn't have a white man that he could recommend, but he would like to recommend one of his students, Booker T. Washington. And so in July of 1881, we established the Tuskegee Institute in Tuskegee, Alabama.
I guess I have two questions on that. One, why do you think he wanted to recommend you? And then secondly, what was the original plan for Tuskegee?
Well, he recommended me because I think he just simply figured that I was the best man for the job. In many ways, the general believed in myself more than I did. But when he felt as though I could do the job, I knew that I could do the job. So I think that he simply recognized my desire, my merit, my experience. And what was the second question?
Well, what was your initial plan for Tuskegee?
Oh, well, the initial plan, you see, the two gentlemen from Tuskegee, Mr. George Campbell and Mr. Lewis Adams, had made a request to the state legislature to open up the school. Tuskegee was a fairly prosperous community, over 2,000 people, about half black and half white, and they wanted the school to educate the colored citizens, and that simply was the plan. And when I came down, I expected to find some type of physical plant, which I did not. And we eventually acquired land, and we started to build our buildings. But it was to give the colored citizens of that area the benefit of a proper education.
Right, given that goal, though, the philosophy that evolved, that you soon developed for the betterment of black Americans, was both sort of influential and controversial. Could you tell us a little bit about that philosophy, what it was, what it meant to you?
Well, our goal was and is to develop the whole person. And again, I have to credit General Armstrong because in many ways I was carrying out the philosophy of Hampton Institute with one exception. And that is that education should be about the hand, the head, and the heart. And the idea is to develop the whole person. You should be producers and not just consumers. So we wanted to teach skills. We felt that industrial education was the best way to make black citizens producers in this country so that they would be a practical benefit for the society as a whole. So that's education of the hand. Certainly, books are important. They should learn how to read and to think and to figure, and they should be exposed to the best that there is to be exposed to. So that was education of the heart, and certainly character is important, that a young man and a young woman's word should be something that could be trusted and that we would be understood to be caring members of the society. So the idea was and is to develop those three parts of the human being. Now, the difference, of course, between Tuskegee and Hampton is that we are a black school, and our goal is to show what Negro civilization can do if it's given the help. And so once we established Tuskegee, we wanted our faculty, both in the industrial aspect as well as the educational aspect, to be Negro teachers. And I've attempted to recruit the best Negro educators I can find from across America. So that was our goal.
But by most reports, this has worked well. People seem to have received your plan, your philosophy. as being successful. When you spoke on it, however, in 1895 in Atlanta, a talk labeled the Atlanta Compromise, it also generated some opposition from those who accused you of suggesting that black Americans abandon their efforts to win full civil rights and political power. What is your response to that?
Well, that speech did engender some criticism, but that was, I think, the best social philosophy because I thought it was practical. You know, that was an interesting place. I mean, that was the first time that a black man had been allowed to address an international audience, a national audience of Southern whites and Southern Negroes and whites and Negroes in the North. And the question that I had in mind was, how do we go about developing the Southland? How do we go about bringing about better relationships between Negroes and whites in the South? And I felt and still feel that if the Negro can get something that the white man wants, you see, then all the other problems will gradually subside. And so when I essentially said, in all things that are purely social, we can be as separate as the fingers yet one in all things leading to mutual progress, I was simply, one, noting the reality that from 1890 until even today, that Southern legislatures, and we are sorry to see this, but they are disenfranchising Negroes by the hundreds of thousands. That's the reality. So the question I pose is, how do we exist in this reality and make the best of it? And I thought that politics, while it's fine, I mean, I vote, I encourage my faculty to vote, but what happens if you can't vote? And the one thing that we do have that we can control, I believe, is ourselves. And we can become contributing members of the society. And if you establish this sea of goodwill among your fellow citizens, your white citizens and your black citizens, then I think that the good white people of the Southland will see the benefit of that and see the benefit of granting all rights to the Negro as well as to the white man. So I felt is this is something that we can control and we can be contributing members of the society leading to the economic development of the Southland.
The fact that you emphasized the South and being in the South and that your critics seem to come largely from the Boston area, do you think there's any connection there as to location, as to positions taken?
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. You know, I've often said that if I lived in Boston, you know, perhaps I would say that too. But I don't live in Boston. I live in the state of Alabama. I'm a citizen of Tuskegee. And if those who lived in Boston would come and live in Tuskegee, perhaps they would have a different outlook. But look, Professor LeBeau, what I'm concerned about is the masses of the Negro people, not that small 1 or 2%, the so-called elite in Boston and other places. And for the masses of the Negro, it is no doubt that industrial education will lead to the development of our people as a whole. So though I can understand what they're saying, I simply don't feel as though it is as significant, because what I'm saying is addressing the masses of the Negroes, and the masses of Negroes live in the South.
Okay. Well, we only have time for one question and a minute left. Could you briefly tell us how things went at the White House? You're being invited to dinner there?
Well, as I've said, it went quite well. I mean, I didn't think that much about it. You know, I received a request from the president asking me to join him, a friend of his and his family, to the White House so that we could talk about issues that we had discussed previously. I'd known Governor Roosevelt for a number of years, and it just seems to be the most natural thing to do. And so we discussed appointments, you know, in the South and matters that pertain to Negroes and society as a whole. And so when the President of the United States extends a request, you know, for you, a to you, it just seems to be the prudent thing to honor that request. And that's simply all that we did.
Good. Well, it must have been a great experience. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you, Mr. Washington, for joining us.
Well, thank you, sir.
Congratulations on publication of your book this year, Up From Slavery. I hope it is well read.
Well, we're quite good. Pleased with that book.
Good. You've been listening to Black American educator, reformer, and leader Booker T. Washington. We'll be back in a moment. You've just heard Charles Pace impersonating or performing Booker T. Washington. Pace is a professor of anthropology and American studies at Center College in Danville, Kentucky. But he's also a founding member of the National Chautauqua Tour and has been giving public performances for that and other groups for over 20 years. Among his characters, other than Booker T. Washington, are Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Malcolm X, and Langston Hughes. Welcome back, Charles.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Your thoughts on Booker T. Washington. Why'd you choose him? Why is he important?
Well, I chose him, actually, because that was the character, after being with the Great Plains Chautauqua for 7 years, doing first Frederick Douglass and then W.E.B. Du Bois, they chose the series Behold Our New Century. And they chose a number of characters that they wanted to be portrayed, and Booker T. Washington was one of those, so I applied and was granted the privilege of doing Washington. So it was really a response to the invitation from the Great Plains Chautauqua. Why I think he's important, well, many historians, as you know, consider the period between 1900 and 1915 the age of Booker T. Washington. And Washington was that link between industrial capitalism, black self-help, and the curing, he thought, of the black-white social problem. And with his base in the South at Tuskegee, with the fact that he had organized black farmers beginning in the year 1898, he was organizing black businessmen, the fact that President William McKinley had gone to Tuskegee in 1897, the fact, as we indicated, President Roosevelt invited him to the White House in 1901. When we look at those key areas of business, farming, the land base, which was the base of most black people during that time, and politics, Washington was the man. Plus the fact that so many hundreds of thousands of dollars from industrial capitalists in the Northeast was filtered through Washington to other institutions. So in many ways, Washington himself became a philanthropist. So he was a singular figure because no black man prior or to this time has, I think, encapsulated so much power in one hand.
No doubt, and clearly important in his time, but yet given where the black American community has been since the 60s, a controversial perspective. What kinds of responses do you get to that kind of characterization?
Well, the response has been overwhelming. Now, I must say, I usually would work on the Great Plains with the Great Plains Chautauqua for about 3 years before I'll take it to other regions. So very few black people actually have seen me do this show, although the year that I was selected, I was at a national conference that the Organization of American Historians and the National Park Service gave in Roanoke, Virginia, and I met many members of the Washington family, and they invited me to come to Tuskegee to do it at their annual family reunion. Unfortunately, the reunion takes place in July, and I'm on the road with the Great Plains in July, and I have not done that. But the response has been overwhelming from the white audience. I think, though, that when I do it before a knowledgeable black audience, they're going to be surprised at the image of Booker T. Washington, the public face of Booker T. Washington, but then again, that was a private face of Booker T. Washington that most of us do not know. And it was that face that was very interesting to find out that Washington was working privately with people like W.E.B. Du Bois to challenge many of the laws and institutions that he was not really supporting, but he was simply quiet about. For instance, he wrote letters publicly to the Louisiana legislature, to the Georgia legislature, and asked them not to disenfranchise black folk. He felt as though, especially the black landowners and blacks who were intelligent, he felt that was sending the wrong signal. And because he felt as though if they were disenfranchised, then the South would be saying to its black citizens, no matter what you do, you will still be punished. And he felt that was a wrong signal. He was also supporting, challenging the Jim Crow seating arrangements, particularly in public transportation. He and Du Bois challenged one of the railroad lines. He was funding a number of black newspapers that had editorials that supported his cause, but yet still were very active in their own community. So that was a secret life that Lewis Harlan talks about of Booker T. Washington that many people in his time did not know, and even today people do not know. Washington was a practical person, and I think that that would be a revelation. As well as he was a business entrepreneur without peer, and I think that would be a positive revelation to black folk. But at the same time, yes, we must criticize Washington for thinking that he could capitulate to a system and reform that system at the same time, which he simply could not do.
Great. Thank you for being with us. You've been listening to Charles Pace, Professor of Anthropology and American Studies at Centre College and National Chautauquan. If you're interested in learning about the history of American Chautauquas, Talking History's Cindy Workman has just the site for you.
The American Memory Collections website at the Library of Congress has a new collection called Traveling Culture, Circuit Chautauqua in the 20th Century. The collection of almost 8,000 publicity brochures, ads, and flyers can be seen at the Library of Congress website at www.loc.gov. Here you will find the history behind the Circuit Chautauqua. The summer camp for families that began in New York in 1904 promised education and uplift, and its popularity grew quickly. During its peak in the 1920s, there were more than 21 circuits providing programs in more than 10,000 communities in 45 states, and an estimated 40 million people saw at least one of these performances. Visit the American Memory Collection website at www.loc.gov.